You are listening to the Indefensive Plants podcast, a show designed to cure plant blindness around the globe. Support for Indefensive Plants comes from listener donations. If you would like to give your support to Indefensive Plants, please consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants. And together, we can help cure plant blindness one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How's everyone doing this week? Today we're talking with someone who I very much admire because they've turned a passion and a hobby into a thriving career with plants. Joining us from Australia is Greg Burke, and Greg is the curator and manager of the Blue Mountain Botanic Garden at Mount Toma in Australia. Now, Greg is a lover of all plants, especially those that are unique to Australia, and as I'm starting to truly appreciate, Australia is home to a bewildering array of carnivorous plants, so that's really our focus of today's conversation. However, Greg is a lover of all things strange in the plant world, and he is an incredible horticulturist. I'm sure he'll be back on this podcast, but again, today is mostly about Australia's unique carnivores. This includes a lot of species that many of the hobbyist growers listening to this podcast might actually recognize, but we're going to be talking about them, where they come from, in situ, how they grow, that sort of stuff. You probably know Greg from Twitter if you're familiar with any of his online content. He's got an incredible following, and he's a great photographer, so he's good at sharing this stuff with the world. So, let's just jump right into it. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Greg Burke. I hope you enjoy. All right, Greg Burke, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about we start off a bit about your background and what it is you do?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Matt. My background, wow. Been interested in plants since I was a little kid, walking through the bush with my parents. But my career in plants didn't start off that way. I started studying to be an electrician at the end of high school and spent 15 years working in the electrical and telecommunications trades.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it wasn't until only 8 years ago that I decided that that world wasn't for me and that I should pursue a career in plants, and was lucky enough to snare a role at the Royal Botanic Gardens Sydney at the Blue Mountains Botanic Gardens site. And the rest is history, really.
Wow, that is definitely, I think, a unique trajectory for a lot of people. You don't hear that very often, but I mean, kudos for finding what you truly love and you know, being brave enough to just go for it, right? I mean, not a lot of people walk away from an established career into something else like so drastically different.
Yeah, I've always said you've got to jump in with both feet, and when you know, I'd spent a lot of my volunteer time and spare time studying and researching plants and carnivorous plants in particular. So when I'd had enough of the telco industry, I decided that I've just got to do it, and the opportunity came up managing the infrastructure at the Botanic Gardens first. So it was a nice way to ease into the Botanic Garden world.
Yeah, that's a really awesome position to kind of, like you said, transition your way in. But so you said that during that time you were volunteering and growing plants on your own. So that's kind of been, I'm guessing, a big part of your life outside of that, the hobby of it all. I mean, were you more of a grower or just kind of someone that liked to go out and look for plants in the wild, or is it a nice healthy mix of both?
I'm not sure I'd say it was a healthy mix, and certainly my friends and family wouldn't say it was healthy.
You're in good company.
plants pretty much took up all my time. So yeah, I had a fairly large collection of plants from sort of my mid-20s, and spent much of my spare time getting out into the wild, you know, whether it was just walking for pleasure or out pursuing individual plants.
Right on. That's awesome, though. And I mean, what better way to learn, right? It's kind of like that mix of hands-on and just experiential sort of education to prime yourself to be ready to take care of and be in a professional setting with plants, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And surround yourself with all the people in the know. I've never been afraid to get out and hassle those people that have been studying a lifelong career of plants and ask them all the questions, because that's where you really learn from those old bodies.
Yeah, I mean, even in my own work, I would say that people growing plants their entire lives have taught me more about my study species than anything in the literature, probably because no one's really taken the time to study the plants that I study. But yeah, I mean, just tapping into that resource of just people that have come before you is such a wonderful way to absorb knowledge.
Yeah, indeed.
So you have a particular interest in carnivorous plants, and you know, I grew up thinking about places here in southeastern North America, the tall pitcher plants, the sundews, the Venus flytrap, but Australia is home to a bewildering array of carnivorous plants, some found nowhere else and others that, you know, maybe people in other continents would be familiar with, at least on the generic level, right?
Yeah, it's just mind-boggling. You know, we've got a group of plants with, you know, roughly 800 species globally, and in Australia we've got almost a third or a little bit over a third of that diversity. You know, we're probably going to hit about 300 species in Australia in my lifetime. It's just incredible.
That is pretty wild. And so were these plants that caught your attention early, or was this something that, like, you started to appreciate the more you started to understand that, like, botany was this amazing world?
No, I used to go bushwalking with my parents. Really, we live on the edge of the bush, so we'd get out and walk through the national parks on the weekends. And being a little guy around that 5-6 years old, you're often looking down at the ground, and I just remember these sundews close to my house at that age. And I think I might have tried to grow a couple then, but never really successful, and then came back to them, I guess, in my teenage years.
Right on. That's neat that you were able to have those types of plants in your backyard. I mean, a lot of people are used to sort of the lawn weeds, that sort of thing. But yeah, being that proximity to natural spaces is really great to hear that could at least put them into context. Because to me, carnivorous plants growing up just felt so alien. I couldn't think of where they could be or where they would evolve. And I'm sure many people listening that aren't familiar with what Australia has to offer as a habitat just think like, oh, the outback, that's like dry and not what I would think for carnivorous plants.
It's such a diverse place, though. You know, it's the driest inhabited continent on the planet. And so, yeah, you do think this isn't conducive to carnivorous plants, but the soils in Australia, they're geologically pretty stable. So Western Australia, which is the epicenter of carnivorous plant diversity, has been comparatively stable for hundreds of millions of years, so very little volcanic activity. So these soils have been able to mold over millennia to provide this environment where carnivorous plant diversity has absolutely thrived.
That's pretty intense. And to think about it as it truly is a hot spot. Like you said, a third of the world's carnivorous plants live there, and it's a lot of different families, right? It's not just the sundews doing well there.
No, we've got six genera. So we've got the Venus flytrap's closest relative in Aldrovanda vesiculosa over here. We've got Cephalotus follicularis, which all the carnivorous plant nerds out there will know, but it's it looks like those tropical pitcher plants of Southeast Asia, but it's more closely related to the cabbage than it is to one of them. It's just a unique example of convergent evolution. And then, of course, we've got the bladderworts, the sundews, as you said, and, of course, those tropical pitcher plants in Nepenthes. We've got between one and four species, depending on your taxonomy, up in northeastern Australia.
And so in terms of thinking about habitat type, I mean, you mentioned that the soils are old, they're very stable, but, I mean, these aren't all coming from, say, a bog. These are coming from a variety of different habitat types, right?
Yeah, we've got everything here. So you've got alpine country. I know our mountains are nothing like the ones over there, but you know, these are snow-covered mountains for many months of the year. So there's one of our most ancient of all the Drosera, Drosera arcturi, occurs up in that alpine country. We've also got the only three tropical Drosera, tropical rainforest Drosera, up in Queensland. So you don't really associate Australia with rainforests, and why plants or carnivorous plants would evolve to thrive in that rainforest habitat. But yeah, the only three species occur up there in the rainforest. And then, of course, the desert country right in the heart of Australia, where the driest conditions prevail, there are Drosera there. So rains might fall only once every 10 years, but when they do come, those plants germinate, do their thing, and then they die off only in a space of about 3 months. So they're able to mass produce, collect the prey that they need to reproduce and then die off. So it's right across the country.
Wow, that's wild. So even down to desert annuals that take advantage of that rare boom and bust period, because I'm assuming, you know, if the conditions are right for them to be growing, then all of the little insects that are going to take advantage of that are out in a boom period too. It makes complete sense. You just narrow your working period to these little favorable windows of opportunity.
Yeah, and when you see these desert species, some of them aren't really that small. Some of them get to about a foot tall. But they are incredibly successful because the conditions out there are drier than they are in the boggy or rainy areas. The fluid that the sungeas produces is far more viscous and really sweetly scented. So they're attracting all those insects in. Things as large as dragonflies and large butterflies are caught by these plants, and they just can't get away. So they catch a huge amount of prey in that short period of time.
Jeez. That has to be one hell of a spectacle to walk up on.
Yeah, it's magnificent. And you can see these things driving down the highway at 100 kilometers an hour. You see that glistening dew in the background of the side of the road.
Incredible. And so before we get any farther into like some of the specifics, I mean, the big unifying factor here that could probably thread all of these together despite their habitat differences, it's the lack of nutrients that has driven these plants to be capturing animal life, right?
Absolutely, yeah. They only occur in the nutrient-poor soils, obviously, where nutrients persist. The carnivorous plants can come into some of these areas, and you do occasionally see a few, but they tend to be out-competed by other plants because, you know, carnivory is an evolutionary last resort because it's such an expensive way to get nutrients. But, yeah, that's that low nitrogen soil is really what has driven this carnivory.
Right. And I mean, that's what's interesting too, is you do have those low nutrient conditions in the desert. You do have low nutrient soils in rainforests and in swamps and up, especially up in alpine country where things just don't decompose because it's not that favorable, or granite outcroppings. I mean, all of these sites can push plants to that sort of extremes, really, of diversification of strategies.
Yeah, absolutely. The granite outcrops in Western Australia are one of the most incredible habitats and very poorly documented, that we have these lenses of rock that reach the surface of the ground, and that thin layer of moss on the rock or that thin layer of soil at the margins of these granite lenses, trees aren't able to compete. They can't get a foothold because the soil is too shallow, and that little band of habitat is where carnivorous plants can really thrive.
Wow, that is absolutely wild. And so in thinking of some of the unique species that you have over there, I mean, you mentioned Cephalotus. That is, like you said, one of the holy grails for carnivorous plant collectors out there. I mean, what is going on with that little plant? Where do you find it? What's it all about?
It occurs only in the southwest in a band about 50 kilometers wide along the coast in the southwestern corner of Western Australia. It's a small perennial plant with a rhizomous stem, so it only grows about 20, 30 centimeters a foot across. So it's a small plant, but it has these traps that are a pitcher in shape. They have a rim and an opening, even like the Sarracenias of North America. So they're superficially similar, but very squat and small. And they specialize in catching ants. So they're in this typical sort of boggy country, and there's lots of ants there because it's another boom and bust piece of country where the ants are able to get out and pick up all these bits and pieces in between rainfall. And these plants are taking advantage of that.
Wow. Just to see them in a pot is something spectacular. Again, you're looking at this strange formation on these leaves that, like you said, superficially resembles other plants that we've seen, but then just to put it in the context of its own unique trajectory is wild. And I had no idea about the ant thing. I mean, that's also incredible, because other carnivorous plants also have these weird relationships with ants and termites, you know, these sort of eusocial, hyperabundant species.
Yeah, and we still don't understand a lot of these things. This plant's been studied fairly well recently, but the interactions with insects and other animals is far greater than we still understand. You know, we've got a fly that lays its larvae in the pitchers of the cephalotus, and those larvae help break down the prey so that the traps don't spoil. So they're eating the prey, dropping their poop in the pitchers, and that's what helps feed the plant. So it's just incredible, those relationships.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that I almost feel like we've been so starstruck at the fact that they're carnivorous plants that, like, a lot of conversations just kind of end there, like, oh, they're eating insects. What more do you need to know? That's amazing. But in terms of the unknowns, oftentimes it's because some of these are probably really hard to access, but also it's just you got to move beyond some of the more obvious stuff to ask, like, okay, this is really complicated. And like you said, I mean, the closer you look, the more beautifully complex it gets.
Yeah, look, I spent a lot of time out in the field looking at these plants, and it wasn't really until about 10 years ago that I started to notice the sundew bugs, the genus Psittacarus. So they're a type of assassin bug that have a really close association with the sundews in particular. So they walk around on the sticky leaves, and they feed on the prey as it's captured by the plant, and then defecate on the plant. But we've got, I think there's currently 3 described species in Psittacarus, but we know that there's another 20-odd species.
Oh, geez.
This is an area that's really captured my imagination in recent years, and we're now starting to notice that these bugs have close associations with many other viscid plants, so not just sundews and stylidiums, but many others, like members of the tomato family and some of our unique sticky plants in the family Goodeniaceae. So I've been looking very closely at these, and we might add a couple of new genera to the carnivorous plant world in the not too distant future.
Wow, that's super exciting, and that's something I want to come back to in terms of new discoveries. We'll put a pin in that for now, but yeah, I mean, just this idea that, again, it looks so simple and straightforward. These plants are sticky, they're attractive to other insects, they land on them, they get stuck, the plant digests them. But then you add this extra layer that it's not necessarily the plant doing it, it could be this insect that eats them and then poops. And, you know, Nepenthes lowii, I made the press because it's the big shrewloo, and there's other Nepenthes that do that as well. But, I mean, to think that other insects have gotten involved in ways that we couldn't even have imagined before, and it all comes down to that whole eating poop. I mean... What the heck?
Yeah, I think even more remarkable than Nepenthes lowii and those other big pitcher plants and their relationships with mammals is this Nepenthes hemsleyana, which has the relationship with a small bat. And the shape of the pitcher is such that the bat can roost inside the pitcher and not get drowned in the fluid, but it drops its poop in the pitcher. So who would have thought that a bat would have a relationship with a pitcher plant? It's just mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels like something sci-fi. Like, you'd expect to read that in some sort of Asimov fiction.
Yeah.
But here it is on our planet. I mean, ridiculous. But, yeah, you also have, as we mentioned, you've got wonderful tropical forests and some really cool sundews that have found a niche in those forests. And there's some extremely strange sundews if you're used to just seeing the more rajulet style with the little spatulate leaves.
Yeah, the Drosera schizandra, which grows on Queensland's highest mountain. Ooh. It is probably more reminiscent of a lettuce than the typical sundew. Yeah, these things are huge. Again, 25 centimeters across, they're a really big plant. And I did a bit of field studies on this one, trying to work out what this thing is eating in the wild, because you couldn't see a lot of prey on the leaves of this plant, and sitting there in the forest and a fly would come along and land on the plant, and then out of the scrub would come a lizard and come and eat the fly. So I'm not quite sure how successful that one is. It seems to catch pollen and other grains on the wind more so than animal prey. So this one may be reliant more on a different diet than an insect diet, but it's certainly able to capture and digest prey.
Wow. And again, just unknowns, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one that's been known for over 100 years, and yet I don't think too many people have spent much time out there in the field making observations of it.
Yeah, I mean, is this something where some of these areas are difficult to get to, or is it just kind of starstruck with the fact that they're weird, they're different, and we'll come back to that at a later point kind of deal?
Yeah, I think because Australia still has so many species to be discovered that most of the botanists that are out there see a plant and just have a quick look at its morphological characters and decide whether it's a new species or not and then move on to the next one. There's just so much going on that we're not able to spend the time to unlock the secrets of these plants.
Yeah, so there you have it, everyone listening. There are plenty of low-hanging fruit out there. That's cool.
Yeah, there's plenty of killer snakes, crocodiles, and the like out here as well. So maybe that has an effect.
Talk about, herbarium and botany biases. We just couldn't go over there. There was a big croc in the way. Jeez. Yeah, so I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, and I know there's plenty of people listening that are like, trigger plants, what's going on with Stellidium? What is going on with these? Because they don't fit the mold as what we would expect out of a carnivorous plant, or at least not initially.
Yeah, I'm still sitting on the fence a little with these guys. I grow a lot of them, and they certainly capture prey, but most of the plants only produce these sticky glands when they're in the flowering phase. There's only a handful that produce sticky glands on the leaves, and generally that's in the juvenile stage as well. So they may be on their way. There may be a couple that are carnivorous, but there are certainly some that have the relationship with these assassin bugs that seem to be gaining some benefit from it. So, yeah, they're kind of there, but, you know, we're talking about a group of close to 400 species, so there's a lot of work still to be done out there as well.
Yeah, and I know they've kind of become this their own. They have their own corner of the plant growing hobbyist trade, right? And so it's one of those things where I think it's a beautiful way to sell a plant, but it also means that there's still a lot of work to be done. And that's one thing that really fascinates me about evolution of carnivory is, you know, you look at something like an Nepenthes or a pitcher plant, and you go, well, whatever the ancestor was, whatever that intermediate phase, if there was an intermediate phase, isn't around today. But to go back to kind of this, like you said, there's a lot of sticky plants out there, and a lot of them have interesting relationship with insects. It brings up a lot of ideas about how carnivory evolves in the first place. And it could be sort of, like you said, something that's on its way there. We're just not living at that time in its evolutionary history to see it fall all the way through.
Yeah, it fascinates me, the fact that, you know, it's easy for a plant to become sticky or to become hairy. So, you know, a plant will often produce hairs to deal with cold or heat or dry, or to prevent prey or caterpillars from eating them. They're less palatable, right, if they're hairy. Then to go to that next stage of sticky leaves, that sort of makes sense, but it's a bit of a leap. But to go from a sticky leaf to one that produces digestive enzymes, that's an enormous step forward.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a lot of retooling of genetic processes, at least in the way we've understood it to this point, is there's a lot of genes that get turned on and turned off. And so, yeah, I mean, I see it all the time with like the Silenes out here in North America. A lot of them are very sticky. They capture a lot of plants. Some of them even have enzymes that break the actual insects down. But in terms of like, does it obtain nutrients? I mean, there's some serious questions that have to be, or boxes that have to be checked before you can kind of go all in on that hypothesis.
Yeah, I guess that's the problem for us, is that we like things to be very clearly defined. It's either in this box or it's in that box. Plants don't play that way. They don't follow those rules.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially something as hyper-diverse as you know, this strategy. It's not even like it's a single family that you can potentially be carnivorous with.
Exactly, yeah.
So, discoveries. I mean, we've hinted at it throughout this entire conversation so far, and there's a lot of unknowns in Australia. It's a big continent. There's a lot of really remote places, and even just in groups that you do know. I mean, you mentioned Nepenthes. There could be one or four, depending on who you ask. So there's still a lot of, just like you said, unknown diversity out there, right?
Yeah, there's every time we go out. I was out just last month in the Cape York Peninsula, far northeast of Australia, and picked up three new species of carnivorous plants. Wow. On that trip. Yeah, and it's not just the fact that we're instantly seeing new things. Our tools are getting sharper, you know, with genetic work, we can have a closer look at these things. But also, as I said earlier, the race to get out and find things means that botanists are just having a quick look. You know, maybe they're kneeling down to look at this plant and go, that's a new species, and then move on. But if you really get down and lay down in the bog, you'll see that there could be two plants that look superficially similar side by side, when in actual fact they're two different species. And one of the species I picked up on this last trip is one of those. So I had looked at it years before and thought it's a little bit different, but I couldn't decide why. And on this trip, I went to have a closer look at that and found there are subtle differences. Seed morphology is different. The glands on the leaves are different. So you pull out these characters to find that there are new things. And then, you know, you don't have to travel far off the main road to get somewhere where no botanist has been for 200 years, or certainly no carnivorous plant botanist has been. And these small soaks or seeps or creekways can be just that little bit remote from the rest of the system, so that a species will occur there. And many of Australia's carnivorous plants are highly specialised to these habitats and therefore highly localised. So if you miss that square mile of scrubland, then you've missed that species.
It is interesting to think about this idea of visibility, right? Because like you said, not everything is going to look drastically different or even that familiar enough to be like, oh yeah, I've never seen that before. I mean, I would go to Australia and everything would look new to me. So despite the fact that even an area could be heavily botanized, if you're, say, not an orchid expert or you're not a carnivorous plant expert, how would you know what you're looking at is special, unique, different, anything like that? For one, and then just like you said, getting into these really localized habitats, you know, this isolation that really does lend to diversification, that alone can be a big hurdle to understanding biodiversity. But until someone goes out there and looks, we don't know.
Exactly. And there are a lot of people getting out there and looking, but you know, there are places, as I said earlier, snakes, crocodiles, and deadly spiders. Australia's full of all that stuff that wants to kill you. And I don't mind getting out in the swamps. I've been close-ish, I should say, to crocodiles in the wild, and they're the sort of habitats where there's not going to be much competition in the way of botanizers.
yeah, that's a big filter, willingness to deal with large reptiles.
Yeah, they're just scaly puppy dogs.
Yeah, sure. But in thinking about where the most discoveries are happening, you said you went out and found three new. I mean, are there certain families or genera of carnivorous plants that are harboring a lot of this diversity? I mean, is it sundews? Is it something else that you're just going like, whoa, I'm going to go look for just this genus today?
Yeah, sundews and bladderworts are the two big ones here. You know, we've got 200-odd species of each in Australia, so there's plenty more out there. It's not like we're going to find another cephalotus out there, although I'm sure there are a few people out there hoping they'll find it. And the Nepenthes have been very well studied, although, as I said, the sharper tools are unlocking secrets there as to how close the relationships are. So there's not much to be found out in those groups, but certainly in the sundews and the bladderworts, there are plenty more out there. And I can think of at least a dozen species that are new that no one's actually working on at the moment. And my list is about 10 as well of new species that I'm currently working on.
And what do you think it is with this group? I mean, is it, like you said, you go out and you see something slightly different, you look at some seed morphology. I mean, what is driving some of this diversity, you think? Is it something like where the habitat was once larger and contiguous, there was a lot of continuous populations that got fractioned into these little isolated pockets when the climate changed? Or is there something else going on, a different kind of gradient, a different kind of prey capture strategy that's really driving some of this crazy sundew diversity or bladderwort diversity?
Yeah, on the East Coast, it tends to be that long sort of continuous habitat, and the plants have slowly diversified and just slightly moving away because they've come for a different relationship. It could be a soil relationship or an insect relationship, or they're targeting a different prey item. So the changes over here are quite subtle, and it's the sharper tool work that's starting to unlock some of those secrets. Whereas in Western Australia, it is the fact that these ancient soils produce very distinct soil types in narrow bands. So you'll get a yellow soil and a brown soil and a white soil, and the mineral content of those is ever so slightly different, but it's enough to push that evolutionary process down different paths. So you'll get species being isolated in those different pockets and then speciating over a relatively short period of time, I guess, in evolutionary terms. But yeah, these plants are isolated and speciating in those tiny little climates or microhabitats.
It's very easy, or at least becoming extremely easy, to see why someone in your position would become so enamored, because it's like choose your flavor, right? I mean, how do you want to study evolution? How do you want to study prey capture? How do you want to study plant-insect interactions? I mean, everything is there, and it's this wonderful quirk of geology and deep time and plate tectonics that have just bred such a playground for plants, you know, across the board, but especially the carnivores. I mean, this is a picture being painted here that, again, I don't think many realize how incredible it is in Australia for carnivorous plants.
Yeah, you can travel a couple of hundred kilometers in Western Australia and see 100 species in 4 or 5 days. It's just incredible.
How often have you done that on the weekends? Just I'm having a big day. See you later.
Pretty often, actually.
I love it. And just before we get into some of the bigger ideas about conservation and sort of indications of things to come, the bladderworts, that's another group I really wanted to touch on, and I'm glad you brought that up in conjunction with the sundews, because again, here in Eastern North America, at least, very used to them being floating aquatic plants. The underwater portion of them looks roughly similar. And their flowers are all elaborate and beautiful, but they're sticking to one sort of niche. But you have a lot of crazy semi-terrestrial ones that really, again, kind of push the mold as to what a North American person such as myself would think of when I think bladderwort.
Yeah, if you visit Western Australia during the summer, it's hot and dry. There's no rain for many months, and it really looks desert. All the grass and herbs are crunchy underfoot, and you wouldn't imagine that that's full of bladderworts, but you come back in the winter and it is absolutely alive with them. The best example is Utricularia menziesii, which occurs on some of those flats, but also on the granite outcrops where the moss dries up and it's crispy during the summer. But of course, when it rains through the winter, it's lush, it's constantly soaked in water. And these plants emerge from tiny little tubers like rice grains, and they'll come up, settle their traps around in the water, and catch their prey. And then what's most interesting about this species is that it's also bird pollinated, so that has these beautiful red flowers about an inch tall, and these tiny little New Holland honey eaters come along and feed on the nectar and pollinate the flowers. So that's just, yeah, when you talk about the typical Utricularia from a bog or swamp, these guys just don't fit the mold at all.
I mean, I've seen that species in picture only, but to hear the ecology, the pollination biology, I mean, that has to be a stunning sight, especially if you're in the know enough to appreciate what you're actually looking at.
Yeah, it's just, I never get sick of seeing that particular species in this good population with a few dozen flowers out. It is pretty special.
Yeah. And obviously, they're bladderworts, so are they still functioning the same as the floating aquatic bladderworts along their underground roots or stems? Do they have the little traps, the spring-loaded suction traps?
Yeah, exactly the same way. So they, again, it's a boom and bust type of environment. Even though they're a perennial, they're reliant on these tiny little insect larvae being in that water for those couple of months a year. So they've got those same sort of suction traps. One of the annual species down there in Western Australia, Utricularia westonii, produces the largest traps in the group, and it has traps about 3 millimetres across, so they're fairly large from a bladderwort perspective. and they don't have a swinging door like the others. They they have the traps pointing in, and they rely on the prey finding its way in that way. So there's some slightly different variations on the theme, but they all have that bladder trap. But I guess they're not entirely reliant on that too. They can still take in nutrients through the water, and they still photosynthesize like any other plant.
Sure, and that's an interesting point to bring up, is many of this is supplementary. I mean, that's one question carnivorous plant growers get all the time, is do I have to feed them? And in good conditions, it's a nice supplement, but isn't necessarily the make or break, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The plants growing at home, I have, 10,000 odd carnivorous plants in my collection. And if I had to feed them with crickets or insects, it'd be a full-time job. But, you know, you can use a liquid fertilizer, thankfully, and just feed them like you would your house plants.
Right on. Yeah, that collection number there really makes me feel a lot better about what I've got going on. Oh, I'd love to see that someday.
Absolutely. Come on over.
Sure. Okay, Australia has a human population, and wherever humans go, environmental destruction happens. So the unfortunate side of this is, I'm guessing, many of these species, especially the ones that are unique to certain substrates or small corners of the continent, are going to be facing pressures, right? I mean, carnivorous plants are not immune to the systems that humans set up to change the ecosystem.
No, they're certainly not. And southwestern Australia, being the most diverse and having those plants that are highly localized, they have suffered the most with pressures of the urban sprawl and farming and mining. So there's a number of species there that are critically endangered. There is, of course, a threat, but a minor one with poaching. And Cephalotus, of course, is the one that's suffered a little bit and certainly been front of mind for a lot of collectors and conservationists. But what we're finding, the biggest threat to carnivorous plants now, or I should say threats, is weed incursion and changes to fire frequency. So the northern sort of tropical side of Australia is suffering weed incursions from things like African grasses in particular, which not only displace the carnivorous plants, but displace local grasses. And then when the fire does come through, these African grasses burn much hotter. Ooh. And therefore they damage the seed store below. So these plants are really threatened by those changes. And weed incursion is one that we really struggle to manage.
Yeah, I mean, it's never an easy issue no matter where you're at, but especially if you have a specific fire regime or some sort of disturbance regime that can be knocked off of its kilter. And it's already kind of on that fine line. That is alarming. But again, is this one of those things where it's a lack of money and effort to be able to fix it? Or is it just such a complex issue at this point that it's just, where do we even begin?
Yeah, probably a combination of the above. What we're finding, though, is that fire practices seem to be returning. So a lot of the original landowners, the Aboriginal people here, are being involved in setting up programs to set fire at the right times of year. Obviously, fire in the summertime is challenging around urban areas or built-up areas. So that is still something that tends not to occur at the right time of year. So they'll either burn in the spring or autumn when it's easier to manage the fire, but of course challenging for plants trying to set seed during fire time. So there are some improvements being made there. From the weed incursion side, there are just so many things coming in that the authorities just simply can't keep up. They're able to manage some very well, others and things like grasses can just move around so quickly that by the time they're noticed as an exotic pest, they're away and they're really challenging to manage. And as I said, there's a lot of crocodiles and snakes and things up there. So some of these areas, they're just hard to get into.
Yeah. And that's always an extra layer of challenge to try and get past. But, you know, you're in a position as curator manager that, you know, you could have a hand in conserving these species. So is there a lot of like ex situ conservation, collections being set up, people growing these sorts of things? I mean, how does the horticultural side of this sort of bleed into these conservation practices outside of just helping with restoration and such?
Yeah, so from the conservation perspective, there's a number of agencies around the country that are doing some good work, but most of the work thus far has been in germplasm storage. So there's a lot of seed banking going on. You know, some plants are maintained in culture or through other means. From a cultivation perspective, it's still more to the collectors that are keeping these things, and some of that's probably good conservation and some of it's probably detrimental to the plants in the wild, because there are still people getting out there collecting plants from the wild. But the cultivation side is also producing a lot more knowledge around growing these things, so therefore, you know, because we can grow them better, they're able to be distributed at a much cheaper price, so therefore taking pressure off the wild. But it is still quite early days in conservation of carnivorous plants in Australia. There's just not the funding there or the research to do so. The focus is on other much bigger, more sexy plants, I guess you could call them.
It is an interesting conundrum, and maybe it's just, again, this North American bias that I have, but it could just, the idea that Australia is such a unique continent when it comes to flora and fauna. But yeah, where do you begin to point fingers at all of the weird, rare stuff, the isolated stuff, and pick different projects? But at least with carnivorous plants, it's one of those things that with a little bit of education, with the right stories being told, I mean, these are plants that can really capture people's imagination.
Absolutely. And I guess that's the most important thing that's happening here, is that we're talking about it and people are becoming aware. You know, we talk about rare mammals and birds and people instantly relate to those. But when it comes to plants, it's really hard to tell the story in a way that people will understand and pay attention. Carnivorous plants, though, seem to break down those barriers, because in a way, particularly with, you know, these are not plants. These are sort of halfway between plant and animal.
Yeah, I mean, it's something, like you said, it's relatable. It's a story you can tell that people can kind of glom onto, because plant blindness is real. People really don't pay attention to plants, and even when you do bring them to their attention, I mean, I hear it all the time, like, oh, that's kind of boring. You're like, no, just listen. And this is the perfect gateway. And so, you know, you have an awesome presence on social media. You've done a great job of bringing the attention of this sort of thing. I mean, that you can hear the passion in your voice when it comes to talking about these plants. Have you been using these as like a tool for education?
Yeah, look, I've been quoted as saying a number of times that my plants are more important than my family. And I think, yeah, you've got to really put it out there and share your passion and put it all on the line, because if you're just talking about it like it's textbook, people don't buy into it. But when they see how much passion there is there, they tend to really get captivated by it. And yeah, I love nothing more than getting out there and talking to groups of people about any conservation work, but of course carnivorous plants, and bringing them along for the ride, if you like, to join in the passion. And it seems to be working.
That's great. And I mean, what better way to do this, not only to expose people to the natural wonders, but then, you know, expose them to a handful of different species that would work well in a home setting, that could be enjoyed as much as you enjoy any other houseplant, but just another layer of incredible coolness to make conversation. People come over all the time and go like, oh, what are those plants with the weird sticky leaves you got there? And I'm like, do you really want to know? Because I've got some details.
Yeah, they wish they never asked. Yeah. But yeah, being able to grow them is a huge step. And kids taking a Venus flytrap home or a sundew home, which is usually their first carnivorous plant, and just being enthralled by the way these things behave and being able to feed their pet, that really takes them along for the ride. And then they talk to their friends, and hopefully the word spreads that way. But yeah, once you're a part of it, you really start to understand how valuable these plants are. And if we can get them hooked in some way, and then bring home other messages about conservation work and preserving our environment, then we've got people all along for the journey.
Right on. Yeah, couldn't agree with you more on that. And now I might ask you one of the worst questions of today for you to answer. But in thinking about all of your experiences with carnivorous plants and especially growing them and collecting them and being around them, do you have any favorites, any instances that stand out that set apart any particular groups or species from your bigger experience with carnivorous plants?
Man, that's always a tough question. But yeah, there's been periods of my life, I guess, where I've gone through phases, and seeing Attenborough's Private Life of Plants for the first time, yeah, and seeing those giant pitcher plants of Borneo really captured my imagination. And then I traveled to Borneo in 2000 and got to see these things in the wild. And that really sparked my interest in those guys. So I had a real love around that time. But more recently, it's been the sundews that have really captured my imagination, the tuberous drosseras of southwestern Australia and the tropical northern sundews, and mainly because I'm studying the relationships more so than the plants. I love the plants, but what I love most of all is how they've adapted to their environment and the interactions and those relationships they've developed. Like, how does a plant and a bug decide that they're going to collaborate on the greater good? That's what really excites me about these plants now.
That's cool. And so that's a good segue there to think about, like, what is on the horizon for you? I mean, you know, you're studying species, you're describing new species. What's next for Greg?
I think the rest of this year, there's a couple of species to write up this year, and then it's really to focus on these other lesser known genera, or those currently not considered carnivorous, and looking closer at the relationships they have with insects and spiders and unlocking the secrets there, and I guess deciding whether we can put them in the carnivorous plant box or the pseudo carnivorous plant box, or if they've got to stay on the other side. But yeah, understanding those secrets and telling those stories is really what interests me at the moment.
Right on. And which genera are these that are ripe for discovery?
So the family Goodiniaceae is a really big one for me. It has a number of genera, most of which are found in Australia. I think out of the 300 to 400 species known, about 280 of them are only found in Australia. So it's a group that's mostly found around here, and yeah, and there's some really cool sticky species in that group, which I want to explore. Solanaceae, so tomato family, there's some really cool plants out there. Actually, there's one growing in my yard here that's covered in these assassin bugs and covered in prey. So, you know, it's quite clearly taking advantage of the prey and the bug relationship, but it's not yet sitting in the carnivorous plant box. So we need to do a bit more with that. There's another group here, which is another huge group of Australian plants, the Eremophilas, and a lot of those are sticky plants, desert plants. So it's getting out into that fringe country, semi-arid country. Yeah, take me away from the crocodiles for a while.
yeah, that sounds like a nice little break, I guess we'll call it.
Yeah, I'm getting older and slower.
Things we haven't had to think about on this continent for a while, but you know what? That's great. And I'm glad you at least have the wherewithal to recognize that in yourself. Oh, man. So this is exciting. I mean, this is an area that's got a lot more to offer the world and curious minds and just botanical nuts like us in general. So if people want to stay on top with what you're doing, learn about all the new species you're about to describe, and just kind of keep track of your adventures, how do you recommend they find out more about you and the greater gardening community that you're involved with?
Yeah, the Royal Botanic Gardens Sydney website has a profile piece there, and it talks a bit about the great work that we're doing at the gardens. So we've got the calyx display down at Sydney Gardens at the moment, which is plants with bite, and that's got a huge display of carnivorous plants in it. At Greg Burke 3 on Twitter, and I don't know what my Instagram one is, but I use that a bit, and I'm on various Facebook pages, and I'm on there doing a bit talking carnivorous plants always.
Awesome. Well, Greg, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us. Keep it up. I really look forward to hearing all about the new plants that you're going to describe and any new discoveries you have with those sticky plants. And open invitation, please come back and nerd out with me again about carnivorous plants, please.
It'd be my pleasure, Matt. And hopefully I can get you over here and hopefully I can get over there. I've never been to the States to see the Sarracenias. I'd really love to do so.
Oh, well, geez, yeah, let's do a swap vacation.
Sounds like a plan.
Excellent. Well, have a great day, man.
Thanks, Matt. Good to talk to you.
Yep. Cheers. All right, that wraps it up for this week. I thank Greg for sitting down and talking with us. He's obviously a very busy man, someone who goes on a lot of botanical adventures, but is also busy growing, propagating, and sharing his love of plants with the world. I highly recommend you follow him on Twitter if you don't already. It's at GregBurke3. I'll put up a link in the show notes to this episode, as well as all the other links that you want to find. Just head on over to indefenseofplants.com/podcast and navigate to each episode to find all of the content that's associated with each episode. As always, thank you for listening. I really do appreciate it. And thank you to everyone who's supporting the podcast. I couldn't be doing this without you. In fact, today we have another special shout out. We have our latest producer on the In Defense of Plants podcast, Joanna. Thank you so much for heading over to Patreon and becoming a patron at the producer credit level. You are really helping make this podcast work each and every week. So again, thank you, Joanna. And thank you to everyone who has become a patron. It really does mean the world to me. And I'm going to have some updates over there pretty soon, especially if you're at the $5 or above level each month. There's going to be some new kickbacks. I promise you that. But just stay tuned. I got to get some things sorted, but there's going to be new content over there in just a couple of weeks. But yeah, if you want to stay on top of In Defense of Plants, the best way to do that is to hit that subscribe button. And while you're over there, leave us a review. Reviews help In Defense of Plants reach a wider audience, and if we want to cure plant blindness, we got to get more people listening. Until next week, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.